This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hi, this is Brent Clough and you're listening to a Radio I podcast. For copyright reasons, we're unable to make all of our Robert Crumb documentary available as an MP3 download. But I hope you'll still enjoy the short extract from On the Run with Robert Crumb.
I have so much to give.
For some reason or other, it grows on you.
But God, look at the type of people who talk like that.
And now she's playing herself in the radio show of her own movie. Radio
I. Nothing seems to fit in this place.
Waving its four legs in the air.
Firing machine guns and you see the bombs.
Radio I.
See, that was the whole thing, is we all read Jack Kerouac and we got all excited that we could have this freewheeling life, you know, you just, you know, you don't let anything stop you, you just go out there and you put out your thumb and you don't worry about money or, you know, where the next meal is coming from, you just go out and do it.
No, not a slogan for a brand of sporting goods, but the words of the legendary underground cartoonist Robert Crumb on the optimism that drove the youth movements of the 1960s. Hi, welcome to the program. I'm Brent Clough. And over the next few weeks on Radio I, we'll be trucking down some pop cultural highways and byways, looking at the legacy of the 1960s in San Francisco, tracing the fate of romantic love in a time of ironic pragmatism, and even taking a look at how those anti-hippies, the punks, have fared as middle-aged suburbanites. Today, it's all about Crumb. But to set the scene, here's Jack Kerouac reading from the book that inspired a generation of wannabe hipsters, On the Road.
It was a sawdust saloon, all wood, with a small bandstand near the john on which the fellas huddled with their hats on, blowing over people's heads. A crazy place not far from Market Street, in the dingy skid row rear of it, Folsom Street, near Harrison and the Big Bridge Causeway. Crazy, floppy women wandered around sometimes in their bathrobes. Bottles clanked in alleys. In back of the joint in the dark corridor, beyond the splattered toilets, scores of men and women stood against the wall drinking wine spodiote and spitting at the stars. Wine spodiote being wine, whiskey, and beer. The behatted tenor man was blowing at the peak of a wonderfully satisfactory free idea. A rising and falling rift that went from Ea to a crazier Ilya, and blasted along to the rolling crash of butt-scarred drums hammered by a big, brutal-looking, curl-sconced guy with a bull neck who didn't give a damn about anything but punishing his tubs. Crash, rattle-tee-boom, crash, uproars of music, and the tenor man had it, and everybody knew he had it, and Dean was clutching his head in the crowd, and it was a mad crowd. They were all urging that tenor man to hold it and keep it, with cries and wild eyes. He was raising himself from a crouch and going down again with his horn, looping it up in a clear cry above the furor. A 6-foot skinny woman was rolling her bones at the man's horn bell, and he just jabbed it at her, playing E, E, E. He had a foghorn tone. His horn was taped. He was a shipyard worker, and he didn't care. Everybody was rocking and roaring. Our girls, Galatea and Alice, with beers in their hands, were standing on the chairs, shaking and jumping. Groups of colored studs stumbled in from the street, falling over one another to get there. "Stay with it, man!" roared a man with a foghorn voice, and let out a big groan that must have been heard clear to Sacramento. "Ha-ha!" "Wow," said Dean. He was rubbing his chest, his belly, his T-shirt was out. The sweat splashed from his face. Boom, kick, that drummer was kicking his drums down the cellar and rolling the beat upstairs with his murderous sticks, rattledy boom. Big fat man was jumping on the platform, making it sag and creak. Woo! The pianist was only pounding the keys with spread-eagled fingers, chords only. At intervals when the great tenor man was drawing breath for another blast of phrase, Chinese chords, they shuddered the piano and every timber, chink and wire. Boing! And the tenor man jumped down from the platform and just stood buried in the crowd, blowing around. His hat was over his eyes. Somebody pushed it back for him. He just hauled back and stamped his foot and blew down a hoarse, bawling blast and drew breath and raised the horn high and blew high, wide, and screaming in the air. And Dean was directly in front of him with his face glued to the bell of the horn, clapping his hands, pouring sweat on the man's keys. And the man noticed and laughed in his horn, a long, quivering, crazy mule's hee-haw, and everybody else laughed, and they rocked. And finally the tenor man decided to blow his top and crouched down and squatted on the floor and held a note in high C for a long time as everything else crashed along skittily boom and the cries increased, and I thought the cops would come swarming from the nearest precinct. It was just a usual Saturday night good time.
Saturday night in San Francisco, 1949. Jack Kerouac reading from On the Road, The Adventures of Sal Paradise and His Pal Dean Moriarty, a celebration of the young and the restless, and the sweet possibilities of a new post-war world. By the 1960s, the boom had delivered a sweet good time to just about any white middle-class kid who wanted it, and a whole new generation was heading for the west coast of the US in search for some kind of hipster adventure. Some Radio Eye listeners will no doubt remember the 1960s, and somewhere along the way, in a comic strip, on a poster, on an album cover, you will have met characters created by Robert Crumb. Fritz the Cat, Schumann the Human, Mr. Natural, and a bevy of lascivious hippie women. Of course, there was also the artist himself, always portrayed as a bespectacled, neurotic, sex-obsessed weakling, dressed like a 1940s slacker. Despite his association with the likes of Janis Joplin, Robert Crumb was always more comfortable with early blues and jazz than psychedelia and rock and roll. And for the last 20-odd years, Crumb, a quintessentially American figure, has lived in the south of France. He's still neurotic, but these days Crumb draws his comic strips for such above-ground publications as The New Yorker. Recently, volume 17 of his collected works hit bookstores. There have been films, exhibitions, critical studies, and all the rest of the paraphernalia of cultural respectability. But the journey from Midwestern obscurity via underground notoriety to the south of France has been, as you'd expect, a very weird one. Let's join Robert Crumb, talking with his Provençal neighbour, former ABC broadcaster Tony Baldwin. For Radio Eye, this is On the Run with Robert Crumb.
Crumb was drawing greeting cards and living a suburban existence in Cleveland, Ohio, with his first wife, Dana, and hating every minute of it.
At the time, to me, was a total horror, the thought of such a thing, of having being tied like that. Because meanwhile, in 67, the summer of love, all around me, people were just doing any wild, crazy thing they wanted. You know, people were having sex in the park and being stoned all the time and taking LSD and... You know, the idea of being tied down for anyone in their early 20s or late teens was unthinkable.
Hello, I'm Tony Baldwin, and this is the story of how Robert Crumb tunneled under the wire and went to San Francisco.
I was working in American Greetings, 65, 66, this greeting card company going in 9 to 5. I had this wife, and I kept thinking every day when I was riding to work, Is this my life? Is this it? This is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life? Go to this job every day and become an alcoholic like all my coworkers who were older than me. And you know, the wife just seemed completely satisfied with that idea, you know, just staying there in Cleveland and, you know, being tied to her family and all that. And I was just seething with restlessness. And, you know, the hippie thing had already started and there was a lot of ferment going on. People were running around the country and talking about all these ideas that were revolutionary at the time, you know, like taking hallucinogenic drugs and losing your ego and the Tibetan Book of the Dead and left-wing revolutionary politics and civil rights movement was real strong. I remember a guy invited me to go down to Mississippi and work on the civil rights voting registration, all that stuff with him, but the wife put the kibosh on that idea. You know, it was just at this time when all this stuff was happening, was right at that moment that I got married and this woman wanted to tie me down. It was driving me crazy. So one day in January 67, cold winter day in Cleveland, after work, I went to this bar where I often went after work, had, you know, put off going home as long as possible. And there was two young guys that I knew around Cleveland, two young hippie guys that were in the bar, and I got to talking to them. They said, "Hey, Crumb, we're going to San Francisco this very night in our car. How about it?" And I said, "Hey, you got room for one more?" They said, "Yeah, you want to come?" I said, "Yeah, love to." So I told this other guy in the bar, I said, "Tell my wife that I went to San Francisco." It was a horrible thing to do to her.
Well, I sort of tired of crying, but I'm out on the road again. I'm on the road again.
I sat in the passenger seat the whole way across since I couldn't drive, and they took turns driving. We just drove straight through to San Francisco. And they knew some guy that lived in North Beach, which had been the old beatnik neighborhood of San Francisco, the Hungry Eye and, you know, all that stuff. And when we got there, this guy had a very tiny apartment, this one tiny room, and we were sleeping on his floor. And these two guys I was with were kind of ne'er-do-wells. And they were perfectly content just to mooch off this guy. And I could see, after a few days, I could see in his eyes that he was getting annoyed at us. And he kept telling us, "You know, there's this new thing happening over in this other neighborhood of town called Haight-Ashbury. You guys ought to go check it out. Go over to Haight-Ashbury." And when I saw that he was getting fed up with having us laying around, I just took off. I went over there and just, you know, took my chance to see what would happen. And I wandered around over there in Haight-Ashbury, and there was this place called the Psychedelic Shop, which, you know, was kind of a focal point of the new thing that was happening, the Psychedelic Shop. And they had these incredible psychedelic posters for rock concerts that, you know, as soon as I looked at that, I could see that these were artists who were obviously taking LSD like I had done. I had taken LSD and had seen, you know, a kind of visionary new way of looking at things. You could, came through in the art very strong. So I went in that place and just sat on the floor and had no idea what I was going to do. No idea. I said, "What am I going to do now? I'm here. Ran away from the wife. I have no money. I had nothing with me, just the clothes on my back." And just sitting there, and there was these other young hippies coming in and out of there, and some of them were sitting around in there too. And it was just, I don't know what the actual thing that was going on in there was. They were selling cigarette papers or something, I don't know, and psychedelic rock posters. And I was feeling rather forlorn and lonely, and then this guy came in who I'd known a little bit in Cleveland, and he saw me and he said, "Hey, Crumb, what are you doing here?" And so we got to talking, and he invited me to come and stay at his house. So went there and stayed there for a few weeks, and then I got a hold of some money that was owed to me by the greeting card company. And I called my wife. I was feeling really guilty and told her, you know, that she should come out and join me, that San Francisco is a great town. And it was at that time, it was a really beautiful city. I was completely amazed by San Francisco after having lived in Cleveland and Chicago and New York and Philadelphia and Detroit, all these really depressing industrial cities. San Francisco just seemed like a sweet little cupcake with Victorian houses and pretty parks, and there was no urban rot, and, you know, rents were really cheap, and the public transportation was really good then, and there wasn't much traffic in the streets, and the air was clean and fresh, and it was really nice, really appealing city then. At that time, San Francisco was like it was a city of old people, and it was had this elegant, old-fashioned air about it. It was surprising, you know. I expected California would be very modern, like L.A. or something, but it wasn't. It was old-fashioned, and all the businesses downtown, I mean, it was not an industrial city very much, you know. It was a city of banking, and, you know, and it wasn't a very big city either. Downtown was really nice, full of like old-fashioned restaurants and cafeterias and old-time 5 and 10 cent stores and clothing stores, and Chinatown was really nice. It was great. And, you know, I still had this kind of beatnik, residual beatnik feeling in certain areas, like around Mission Street, where there was also like a kind of a population of California drifters, you know, these migrant workers and bums who drifted up and down the West Coast. And San Francisco had a very accommodating section of old hotels and soup kitchens and pawn shops for those people. And beatniks kind of lived in the midst of that, and also North Beach. I remember our first landlord in San Francisco, and when I finally rented an apartment in Haight-Ashbury, was this old-time guy, and he didn't understand what was happening at all in Haight-Ashbury. He was just, and those people, the old-timers of San Francisco, were totally amazed when that, you know, those millions of young kids flocked to the city there. They didn't know what to make of it. There, you know, on Haight Street there at that time in 67, there were still these old stores and old taverns and things where these people just like gazed in wide-eyed wonder at what was going on. They had no idea what to make of it all, these kind of elegant, old-fashioned people. Through that year, 67, that just more and more young people were flocking to San Francisco, you know, became this well-known mecca of people that wanted to, you know, join the hippies. And Haight-Ashbury just turned into an incredible zoo. It was, the streets were just constantly filled with young people wandering up and down, not knowing what to do with themselves.
This is Radio I on ABC Radio National, and you're listening to cartoonist Robert Crumb talking with Tony Baldwin.
Meanwhile, the sociology department of San Francisco State College conducted an in-depth study of 50 residents of the Haight-Ashbury scene, and it found that a mere 14% lived alone. 25% shared housing with 10 or more people. Only 2% were over 30, and 60% were between the ages of 16 and 21. 70% were from outside California, and 90% said they had taken LSD.
LSD was central to the whole thing. I mean, people try and play that down now, and they get uncomfortable when you start talking about the fact that LSD was one of the main things that turned left-wing, serious political anti-war movement into something religious and visionary after that. It was no longer just political and you know, folk music and help the Negroes and fight the war and all that. It became religious, became mystical, you know, saving the earth and the preciousness of nature and living close to nature, living spontaneously. You know, it became much more radical and extreme in its purest form, you know, because of LSD. LSD was the road to Damascus for the hippies. It just knocked you down and it's like a blinding bright light in your face, you know, showing you something much deeper and vaster than merely rebelling against a political system. You know, rebelling against or deeply questioning the whole validity of industrial civilization per se.
But Crumb also noticed that hippies were quick to claim the spiritual high ground with all the tedious one-upmanship of recent converts.
Since it was mostly children of the middle class, it was immediately something for them to be smug about. Oh, I've seen the light and you haven't, you know, kind of attitude they went around with, which became really insufferable. I'm beautiful, I'm spiritual, I've lost my ego and you haven't. You know, it's like meeting some smug Christian who says, I'm saved and you're going to go to hell unless you too are saved. You know, it's kind of that attitude. And it became like every social gathering became an encounter group where everybody sat around trying to out-cool each other, you know, it's really annoying. I mean, the positive things that came out of that were people really saw through for a while the whole hype of consumer culture, the whole hype of technology and, you know, how technology is going to save us and all that crap and somehow the values of living simply and all that stuff, you know. And the ecology movement, I think, was really sparked by that. I think living in the woods wasn't particularly comfortable. It wasn't that uncomfortable. It was summer. I don't know. Nobody had any plans for the winter. They're all camping out in the summer in this woods. Nobody knew who owned it. Somebody said, well, some friend of mine told me it was okay, and he got the idea from some other guy, and, you know, these people were just scattered around this place. And there's all these problems. Like, there was some people, there was a house on this piece of land, you know, somewhere in rural California. And some people had taken over the house, and they thought all the rest of these people were ne'er-do-wells and wouldn't let them in the house. So there was this, already had a, by the time I got there, was this bitter feud between the people in the house and the people that were out in the tents. This couple that I knew that was living there, I was kind of camping out with them, and the girl decided one day, said, oh, let's make a pie and bake it in the ground under some hot rocks like the Indians used to do, you know. We'll make a cherry pie. There's lots of, like, berries growing around here. So we picked berries, la-di-da. She made a crust, and we put them in the crust, and we put it in the hot rocks and put the hot coals from the campfire over it and dug it up an hour later and let it cool off. And then we tried to eat it, and it was just god-awful. It was completely inedible. But nobody would say it was inedible. People would try and gulp it down, and then, you know, I guess I've had enough, you know. You couldn't actually say, oh, we did something wrong. It needed sugar is what it needed. You can't just cook berries. They just tasted horrible, sour as hell, you know. You know, sugar was uncool, you know. Sugar was completely unhip. You're down on sugar, so. These people were trying to live some ideal in the woods and live vegetarian, organic, and all that stuff. And then another thing that would happen is every few days, a whole bunch of them would sneak into town and go to the hamburger joint and sit around guiltily, sheepishly eating hamburgers and, you know, not talking about it. You know, it's like committing this sin, going to town having hamburgers, joining the cash economy once more and eating the worst thing imaginable, a hamburger, a greasy hamburger, which was just, you know, so, I mean, it's all the worst sins you could commit. You know, they idealized the Indians. They had no idea that the Indians, you know, were actually this really rough, hard-ass people who put their old people out on ice floes or whatever, you know.
Crum also saw that there was one section of the San Francisco population that wasn't particularly overjoyed with the hippies, and that was the established older generation of beatniks who ruled the bohemian roost in the Bay Area from the late 40s onwards.
They had contempt for the hippies, because they thought the hippies were kind of like debased, non-intellectual media, children of the media who were just kind of like trying to get in on the fun and didn't understand any of the intellectual, existential, you know, aspects of what it was really like to be a beatnik. And also, like, the land of the beatniks was a very exclusive, hip little clique, you know, and they kind of liked that about themselves, that they were a small group apart from the rest of the hordes, you know. And here, when the hippies flocked to that and everybody wanted to be Jack Kerouac, they just saw that as a debasing of their exclusive little private thing, you know. It's like the old idea of bohemia was completely shattered by that, and it's never been regained, really. It was over after the hippies. There's no more bohemia. You know, everybody became a beatnik, essentially. At the same time, most of those people, those older hipster types, were, you know, they were opportunists, and here was their chance to play guru, you know. So they each gathered around them, all the ones that I met, the older ones that were 10 or 15 or 20 years older than me, gathered around them a coterie of young, worshipful kids, you know, because everybody was looking for that older person who had been a hipster to tell them where it's at, to guide them into the mysteries of being a hip person.
Perhaps the most successful of the self-appointed gurus was the late Timothy Leary.
Timothy Leary was both inspired leader and a snake oil salesman at the same time. He's a typical classic, what do you call those, religious demagogue type guys who give out a great, beautiful speech about, you know, turn on, tune in, drop out, and everything that went with it. It was very inspiring. I was inspired by him. But at the same time, he was an opportunist and took full advantage of it to glorify his own ego and to get laid and everything else and to make money and everything, you know, the whole schmear. He was a man of probably somewhat questionable ethics and moral integrity. He was a showman, mostly. I mean, they had these love-ins, and Leary and, you know, these other guru guys would get up there on stage and put on a show, you know, rouse the crowd up into a height of, you know, burning hippie enthusiasm, you know.
Poet Allen Ginsberg also made the successful crossover from beatnik hipster to hippie guru.
Classic. classic example. Oh, yeah, he became a guru, a total guru of the hippies, and loved it, ate it up. He'd get up there on stage and, you know, just chant Om or something in his, you know, robes and everything, and they loved it, ate him up. He was a hero. They were all heroes. All the those people from the beatnik hipster era, you know, they were our antecedents and the people we looked to. So, like Kerouac, it killed him, it destroyed him. They wouldn't leave him alone. They pestered him to death. He couldn't escape from them, hippies. They climbed over his fence to get at him. He just wanted to sit and drink quietly in his house with his mother or whatever, and they hounded him to death.
In the late 1960s, Crumb the cartoonist was still an unknown, an itinerant illustrator. He was living in San Francisco, deeply unhappy with the whole hippie scene and desperate to make a break.
I was still drawing. I never stopped drawing. I was drawing and drawing and churning out crazy stuff. I started giving cartoons to these underground newspapers that were, you know, cropping up all over the place. And they would print anything. It didn't have to be good or anything. They would print almost anything people gave them. It didn't have to be coherent. It just had to look like some hippie thing, you know. And some of those editors thought my cartoons were funny, and they were kind of related to the hippie thing and psychedelic stuff. So I was doing that, but I wasn't getting any money for that. No, they didn't pay anything. All the offices were just these slapdash crash pads where people sleeping on mattresses in the corners and stuff. I don't know how they ever organized getting an issue out of their paper. But the part of the hippie culture that read at all, that looked at anything on print at all, started to recognize my work a little bit. And this one underground paper editor from Philadelphia, I sent him some cartoons, or he picked them up from some other paper or something, I forget. And he asked me to do a whole issue of his paper, of comics. So I did that. I was very inspired at the time. The LSD had me going. I was visionary and had somehow managed to adapt this old cartoon style to this hippie hallucinogenic, you know, vision. And some people really liked that. And so I did this whole issue of his paper. And then he suggested I do a whole, just do comic books. And he would publish them, entire comic books. So I did these Zap comics. And that guy disappeared. I don't know what happened to him. But another guy came along and offered to print them. And it was a small hand-fed press. So we printed them on this press. And then we folded them and stapled them all ourselves. And went around and sold them to stores on Haight Street.
However, initially, some Haight Street stores were fairly confused by Zap comics.
A lot of the proprietors of these hippie stores, like the Psychedelic Shop and these other places, they first saw this comic. They said, what is this, a comic book? We don't sell comic books here. What is this? Because it looked, on the surface, like a conventional comic book, you know. It didn't really look, didn't have the flowing lines of, you know, Art Nouveau psychedelic designs like the psychedelic posters did, you know. It didn't have that. It just looked like Popeye or something, you know. So they, what is this? They didn't understand it at all. But it caught on. It caught on very fast, actually. In 6 months, it was very well known. Zap Comics was very well known all over the, through the whole hippie subculture and all over the country. And even in Europe, in later years and years later, even now, I still find out how those Zap comics, we printed 5,000 of them of the first issue, and some of them got to Europe right away. They were all of, people passed them around, they were looked at, people found them real interesting, and artists started coming around and being interested in the idea of doing hippie comics like that, and the whole thing just then mushroomed in 68 and caught on very fast, and before I knew it, I was this hippie hero, and all of a sudden, you know, very attractive young girls were presenting themselves to me, something that never happened before in my life. Suddenly, like, the most attractive members of this hippie culture were there at my beck and call. It was really amazing. I was completely flabbergasted. That was the best thing about that whole thing. The downside of it was that the phone never stopped ringing, and people had pestering me constantly for drawings they wanted, you know, to promote themselves or their shtick, or my, you know, my poet friends all wanted me to do the covers of their poetry magazines, and older guys wanted me to do these signs for their stores. And it was horrible. And I didn't know how to say no to anybody. And so I was just like frantically, constantly working, trying to keep everybody happy, you know.
But some of Crumb's artists and writer friends seemed to be able to be a good deal more relaxed about life than he ever could.
One of my friends was a hippie poet, and you know, another one was a kind of a guy who had tried to be an actor for a while and gave up on that, dropped out of that. And this one friend who never wore shoes, and he was always tripping around in the park playing his bamboo flute, and you know, had smelled like patchouli oil, and you know, always had like beautiful hippie clothes and everything. But you know, some of those people could pull off being a completely carefree hippie. That's the way he was, you know. Just, he had the time of his life. He had a ball. You know, I'm sure he looks back on that period with great fondness. Late 60s. He had nothing but fun. Stoned all the time and just tripping around. Tripping down the cobblestones. Looking for fun and feeling groovy.
Feeling groovy.
He had it all wired. He knew how to live, that guy. Always had a very relaxed and easy time breezing through life. And he used to take me with him on his adventures, and somehow he would have a great time and I would end up in some hellish situation sort of because of him, but it wasn't really his fault. I was always too uptight. I mean, to me it was a hostile universe always in my life, you know. I was afraid of everything. I couldn't be like that at all, and I couldn't tell whether there was something wrong with me or what. I just didn't know, you know. And it was I felt that way a lot during that whole phase of the 60s. I felt kind of uncomfortable, and so I didn't fit in somehow. I couldn't really pull it off, you know. I couldn't kick off my shoes and dance in the park. I just couldn't do that. I didn't have it in me.
Crumb's newfound status as a luminary of the San Francisco hippie scene brought him a number of interesting new friends, including singer Janis Joplin.
Joplin was from Texas, and she knew these guys from Texas that I knew, Gilbert Shelton and these other people. And she was a smart girl, and she was around the neighborhood and hung around with these same people I hung around with. And she wasn't, you know, nationally known yet. I remember going to see her at the Avalon Ballroom, and you could tell right away that she was... had an exceptional voice, that she was going to go far. You could see, you know, she was really, you know, an exceptional singer. And she started out singing old-time blues like Bessie Smith, her initial stuff that she liked. So, you know, she was kind of a folk Nick originally. She asked me to do a cover for their album. She asked me how could I say no. I liked her. I wanted her to like me. I wanted all girls to like me. It's always much easier for girls to get me to do something. Do some artwork for them. She liked me. She liked S. Clay Wilson, these other cartoonists. She used to come around and, you know, we'd drink and hang out and laugh about stuff. I even made out with her once. She hung around with this group of girls that were these kind of loudmouth, hard-drinking, hippie-oaky girls. You know, kind of tough and rough, sort of intimidating. And one time I was at Wilson's house, S. Clay Wilson, and he liked to drink and party, and he had this girlfriend who was a real nice girl from the Midwest who eventually left him, but... We're sitting around his house one night, and he says, Crumb, why don't you call up Joplin? Come on, she knows you better than me. She knows me. Call her up. Get her over here. Let's drink with Janis. I said, nah, I don't like to. She just wants to, you know, pour that horrible, like, rotgut that she drinks down your throat, that Southern Comfort stuff. It's awful. I said, I don't know. It makes me nervous being around those people. I said, come on, call her up. So I called her, and she said, yeah, sure, we'll be right over. So she came over to Wilson's house with these four girlfriends of hers, and they were tanked up, they were wild, they were game for anything, and they're real kind of intimidating, you know. And Wilson was completely terrified by them. And he just cringe in the corner with his girlfriend, like holding her really tight. And while they all kind of like, you know, jacked me around, he watched while they all kind of like kidded and pushed and pulled at me for a couple hours. Jesus. You know, it was kind of like a little bit proto-feminist and everything, you know, it was scary. You know, it's feminist hedonist, rough, tough girls. And she was starting to get well known at that time. So they had that going too. They were the ultimate hippest, coolest girls around, you know. Sunshine, Patty Cakes, and Janice, and I forget the other one's name. Sunshine. Oh, boy.
Hiding underneath its haunted shade. But you know,
in the intervening years, much has been made to romanticize the sadder aspects of Janis Joplin's life and career. But according to Crum, she was a genuinely tragic figure.
She was. She was depressed. She was homeless. She was pockmarked, you know, desperate to be loved and all that stuff, you know. And what really killed her was the fact that she couldn't get away from the sycophants, you know. She couldn't get away from these people. And they just, you know, the same thing happened to these other people, Morrison too, and Hendrix, all of them. They just... too many people around them just feeding off their energy, just like, you know, leeches. And the last time I saw her, I couldn't get close to her. This circle of people around her, and whenever one of them left, someone else would immediately fill it, surrounding her. She'd bought a great big house in Marin County, this huge, ridiculous mansion, and she had a big party there. And, you know, I kind of looked over this crowd at her and said, "Hi, Janice." And she said, "Hi, Crum." And they just, you know, you couldn't break that circle around her, just surrounding her of people. It's horrible. And that's the last time I saw her alive. A couple of months later, she called me up. I was living at this hotel by myself. It was another time I was trying to break up with my wife. And she called me there and wanted me to do some lettering for an album cover. And she just was real hard-ass about it. I see there was something really wrong with her, something gone completely wrong with her life. And that's the last time I talked to her. She died a couple months after that. Fell face down on the floor from an overdose of drugs and died in her own vomit.
Despite her personal problems and ultimately lethal drug habit, Janis Joplin represented a new kind of independence among women in the counterculture, which came partly from what Crum saw as a failure on the part of hippie men to fulfill the traditional male role.
In the early 60s, when it was still the beatnik era, I mean, the role of the hip chick was really to service and take care of the hipster man. And women were still programmed from the earlier, you know, female idea that, you know, you take care of the guy, you know, and if he's a real hipster and a creative artist type, then he's valued for that. You value him. And if you want to be a hip chick, your place is to provide a nice, sweet, comfortable environment for this hip artistic writer, artist, poet, musician, whatever, you know. When the hippie era, when you had, like, you know, millions of people wanting to be writer, artist, poet, musicians, and the whole thing became very devalued then. And women, you know, quickly learned they really had nothing to gain, and also the guys were just running around all over the place to this woman and that woman, and you know, they got nothing in return for providing a nice environment for these men, you know. So it became quickly disillusioned with that whole thing. And I remember the beginnings of feminism very much involved in that kind of women, just disgusted and fed up with the fact that men were totally useless. Most of them weren't really doing anything even of value. They weren't doing anything particularly interesting. They were just flitting around, you know, being free as the birds. And after a while, these women quickly saw that in the white hippie culture, there was nothing particularly heroic about these guys. They're just sitting around doing nothing and expecting to have free sex and be waited on and have a nice home provided for them when they feel like coming to it. And that quickly became disillusioning for a lot of women. Saw it happen. It was obvious that's what, a lot of what it was about. They got nothing in return, in exchange for being a traditional female in that situation. They didn't get provided for. They didn't get fidelity. They got nothing. They got the shaft. A lot of the men really assumed and expected the women to do everything, not only to provide a nice home, but also to work, to have jobs and support them. If it was only about sex, that would be one thing, but it was about economics too, you know. It was about stability and all that stuff, and whose role and whose duty was it to provide those things and do the what used to be called, quote, shit work. You know, in any situation, I mean, in the left-wing politics was all broken up over that, too, because women were expected to do all the shit work in the, quote, movement. You know, do all the leafleting and all the secretarial work and all the boring stuff. All the men, you know, could traipse around and make speeches like Abby Hoffman and stuff, you know, or Eldridge Cleaver or any of them. That became a big conflict. But sexually, I mean, women had fun, too. I mean, a lot of women in our age group will reminisce very fondly about having wild, loose sex and having, you know, lots of different lovers and everything in those days and how much fun and what a big adventure it was. They were out for adventure, too, you know. They wanted to have all that loose, open experience also, you know. That's what attracted a lot of those women, a lot of those young girls, you know. The idea of you don't have to just get married and be a housewife. Kids today, it's, you know, it's scary, the AIDS and everything. It's not the same ball game at all. And nowadays, I mean, nobody knows what their roles are and how you're supposed to, like, you know, get together with somebody of the opposite sex. I don't even know how to go about doing that. So many taboos and incorrect, you know, you're not supposed to be a sexual predator or, you know, you're not supposed to come on to a girl. I mean, when I was young, the art of coming on to girls was, people sat around and discussed that endlessly, you know. It wasn't considered anything wrong with it. The basic idea of it wasn't questioned. It was just a matter of what was the best way to go about it. You know, what was the most artful way to come on to girls, you know, pick up girls.
Crumb's refusal to portray the world and its inhabitants, particularly its female inhabitants, other than how he sees them, has earned him a certain amount of hostility and accusations of personal bigotry and intolerance.
Racist, sexist, misogynist, you know, all those things. Because I vented all my hostility and rage in my comics on about everything. And, you know, some of those things, it's acceptable to vent your rage against, you know, the government or against big business, that's okay, but it's not acceptable to vent your rage against women, against, you know, other races, or even to make fun of racism is not acceptable. Just taking it at face value. People just don't get it, you know. You can't expect everybody to get it. It's not for everybody, that's all. People are like children, you know. Most of them, they just, you got to give them something, spoon feed them something real simple for them to understand. If it's not, then they get all in a panic about it. You know, the human race likes to advertise itself as being much better than it really is. Things have to be simplified. You got to find scapegoats. This is good, that's bad. You know, these people are good, those people are bad, or whatever. And it's just always a way of pointing the finger at somebody else and taking the heat off yourself or off something more complicated and messy to try and figure out. It's too difficult, so we'll just blame it all on them or that guy or, you know, that idea. Or, of course, it's hypocritical. Oh, look how weird he is, or look how sick that group of people is, or whatever.
Perhaps the biggest irony about Robert Crumb is that the man who subsequently came to be identified most closely with the mid-1960s hippie movement was never particularly taken with it himself.
It's funny because at the time I was involved in that, I really felt very outside of the main thrust of it, you know, because I really was not a full-fledged hippie. I just couldn't do it. And I bought into some of it, but I never saw myself that way, and stylistically was not a hippie at all and didn't like the music. the 20s is much more attractive to me than the 60s stylistically. The way people dressed, the way the world looked, and the music that they liked, and the way they danced and everything, to me is much more appealing than the 60s, which I thought was stylistically very lame in a lot of ways. I like the way the hippie girls look, though, I must say. That appealed to me. They had very loose and naturalistic, unshaven legs and long hair and no makeup and all that stuff. That appeals to me. But at that moment, in 65, 66, it was very exciting. If you got in the subway in New York, it's 1965, and you had been a person who took LSD, if there was another person on that subway who had also taken LSD, you immediately knew who they were. You knew each other. You look in their eyes and you knew, and they knew that you had, you know. It was like that, you know. It was like this kind of intimate brotherhood of people who knew something, that had seen through the whole thing in some way that most people didn't have a clue at all. But there was that golden moment.
We've been On the Run with Robert Crumb. Technical production was by Colin Preston. I'm Tony Baldwin.
The legendary Robert Crumb, looking back on San Francisco in the 1960s, with one-time ABC broadcaster Tony Baldwin. Next week in Radio I, we meet one of the precursors of the hippies, a real live beatnik. San Francisco Bay Area poet and playwright Michael McClure was among the first generation of beat poets and writers, and, as he puts it, a professed mammal patriot. Next week, in Baby of the Beats, McClure traces his ecological roots and reads some of his beast poems.
We come from nowhere. And it's nowhere where we go. There's not even blackness where we go. No silver light or sparkling snow. No smell of Spanish roses.
Michael McClure, San Francisco Bay Area poet and playwright. He was the baby of the beats. He was the young one among the first generation beat poets and writers. He was the beautiful poet who Jack Kerouac wrote about under the pseudonym Pat McClure in his novel Big Sur. Quote, McClure is the handsome young poet who's just written the most fantastic poem in America called Dark Brown, which is every detail of his and his wife's body described in ecstatic union and communion and inside out in every which way, unquote. You see McClure in pictures standing outside City Lights bookstore, in group sittings with other eagle-eyed bohemians, or off in the alley talking with Allen Ginsberg and Bob Dylan. And that's him standing naked with a full face and head of werewolf hair. After the beats, in the pop cultural milieus of the 1960s, he was the poet, mentor, friend of Jim Morrison of The Doors. Some say Morrison modeled himself upon McClure, upon the romance of the poet.
We come from nowhere, and it's nowhere where we go.
Michael McClure, the baby of the beats, next week in Radio I. And that's our program for today. A reminder, here at the I, we're keen to hear from you, your comments and your ideas. You can email us via our website at abc.net.au/rn and just follow the prompts to our homepage. Many of our programs can also be downloaded to an MP3 player for later listening. But, unfortunately, our Robert Crumb special isn't downloadable. These are the vagaries of copyright law. Lots of other ones are, though, and you'll see them there. Studio production this week by Tony McGregor and Manny Vossestrom. I'm Brent Clough, inviting you to stay with Radio National for an afternoon of terrific listening. Thank you.
Radio I.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.